Welcome to House of David Fellowship. My name is Julie Eidlett. Today is February 7th, 2015, and the name of the presentation today is called Marriage Mythology, Debunking, Part 3, Debunking the Myths of the Fall. The first thing we're going to do is a quick review of Parts 1 and 2 because it's been a long time since I did those presentations. Our presentations on marriage are designed to fit together, so if we miss one in the sequence, it makes the understanding of later presentations more difficult. If you have not heard Marriage Part 1 and Part 2, you can find them on houseofdavidfellowship.com's website under Archives, and they're dated March 1st, 2014, and April 4th and 5th, 2014. Now, studying those teachings will help you understand why we say that none of these myths that we're about to review have a place in the Messianic Assembly. The first one that we covered in Part 1 was called The Man Adam Was Created Before the Woman Eve, showing that the priority and superiority of the man was ordained by God. That's the whole cardinal order equals importance myth. We took care of that one. The next myth we covered was man's authority over woman is illustrated by her being taken out of man, being made from his rib. That was the source equals subjugation myth. Next, we handled man was made in the image of Yahweh, but woman was made in the image of man. Next, we covered Yahweh gave Adam the man, but not Eve the woman, dominion over the earth. That was the manager plus the secretary maid nanny myth. If you have any questions about any of those, or if any of that sounds like something you thought, wait a minute, I thought that was true, go back and listen to the other teachings. And then in Part 2, we covered one myth for the whole entire presentation because it was that deep. The woman Eve was created to be an assistant helpmeet for the man Adam in his role of taking dominion. That was the CEO and his secretary maid nanny myth. All right, before we start, we go over this each time, and that is, I just want to remind everybody that we come to the text with already having preconceived notions. It is in our best interest to do away with those as best we possibly can. The fine print here says that failure to do so may result in skewed vision and may interfere with the working of the Ruach HaKodesh. That's not something we want to do. We talked in Part 1 about how the lullaby effect, it makes it very difficult to come to the text fresh and without our preconceived ideas, and that sometimes when we've read the same stories, especially in the beginning of Genesis, the same stories over and over and over again, that the stupefying effects of familiarity just completely numb our ability to see clearly. This is the slide that we're going to show every time I'm quoting one of the pagans from whom we got a lot of the views that we have on marriage. Part 1 and Part 2 go over that very, in depth, so I'm not going to go over it again, but just know that whenever I'm about to quote pagans, this is the slide that will come up. Pagan number 1, Euripides Hippolytus. Euripides was a playwright, one of the three most famous playwrights in classical Greece, and his play Hippolytus was a tragedy about the son of Theseus, who was the mythical king of Athens. Hippolytus swore a vow of chastity, and this play includes his furious tirade on his hatred of women. All right, before I read this, a quick side note is the noun bane, it's kind of archaic. We don't really use that word that much anymore, so I'm going to give you a quick vocabulary lesson here. The noun bane refers to anything that is a cause of harm, ruin, or death. The source of this word is Middle and Old English bana, meaning destroyer or murderer. The meaning of deadly poison is seen in the names of the poisonous plants like wolf's bane and henbane. Here's the quote. O Zeus, why have you settled women in the light of the sun? Women, this bane, mankind find counterfeit. If you wish to propagate the human race, it was not from women that you should have given us this. Rather, men should have put down in the temples either bronze or iron or a mass of gold and have bought offspring, each man for a price corresponding to his means, and then dwelt in houses free from the female sex. But as matters stand, when we are about to take unto ourselves a bane, we pay out the wealth of our homes. The clear proof that woman is a great bane is this. Her father who begat her and raised her adds a dowry to her and thus sends her off in order to be quit of a trouble. But her husband who has taken this creature of ruin into his house takes pleasure in adding finery to the statue, lovely finery to a statue most worthless, and tricks her out with garments, wretch that he is, destroying by degrees the wealth of his house. For those of you who did hear Marriage Part 1 and Part 2, are you remembering why we first started quoting these guys? A lot of times we'll hear a quote like this and we'll just kind of be incredulous or we'll laugh at the ridiculousness of it. But what we really need to feel is alarm. Alarm because we've been eating of the fruit of this mindset, ignorantly, maybe in deception, but still ingesting it and regurgitating it through all the doctrines that we have inherited from our fathers. Now, as we go through this presentation, let's be introspective and ask Abba to shine light on areas where we have been deceived. Alleluia. The prophet Jeremiah was right. The Gentiles shall come unto thee from the ends of the earth and say, surely our fathers have inherited lies. What we're doing at this very moment is walking out what Jeremiah prophesied. We are digging into what we have learned to see where we have inherited lies. This is the slide I'll bring up each time. I'm going to quote one of the ones known as the church fathers. This is the fathers of the Christian church. Augustine, in his Questions on the Heptateuch, he says, it is the natural order among people that women serve their husbands and children their parents, because the justice of this lies in the principle that the lesser serves the greater. This is the natural justice, that the weaker brain serve the stronger. This, therefore, is the evident justice in the relationships between slaves and their masters. They who excel in reason excel in power. Remember Augustine from part one? He's been called the most significant Christian theologian since New Testament times. And he's commonly known as the father of Western theology. I will say this, if you have not heard it, you've got to go back and hear some of the story of Augustine's life and his homosexuality and some of the other issues that he struggled with that will give you some context. When I tell you details about the men's lives that I'm quoting, it's not necessarily an ad hominem attack. It's context, and we need to have context because our views don't just come into existence out of the blue. They're part of the lifestyle that we have lived. Now, regarding Augustine, most of the doctrines that Torah keepers reject can be traced back to Augustine.
That's a mystery. I don't like mysteries.
This is the slide we'll show whenever I'm going to quote rabbis or ancient Jewish sources. All right, born Yosef ben Matityahu, he started out as a law-keeping Jew from a priestly family, but he fully defected to the Romans and became a completely Hellenized Jew. He even changed his name to Titus Flavius Josephus. All right, his works record the first history of the Jewish people and a lot of background of the early church. It's interesting to note that out of his four wives, one died, one left him, and he divorced another. But maybe that didn't have anything to do with this quote. Josephus says the law, I'm not sure what law he's referring to there, I know it's not Torah, a woman is inferior to her husband in all things. Let her therefore be obedient to him, not so that he should abuse her, but that she may acknowledge her duty to her husband, for God hath given the authority to the husband. This is a longer slide that will show each time I'm bringing up a new myth that we're going to pick apart. So, let's re-examine what we've been taught.
Yeah, me too, isn't you, Jay?
Myth number one in part three. Adam named Eve, thereby illustrating that God had given him authority over her. Okay, a related myth is that Adam named Eve just like he named the other animals that were under his authority. Duh. Now, in part one, we went over the idea that Ha-Adam, which was the Ikad unity of humanity, is who named the animals. Okay, that's covered extensively in that one. I'm not going to go back over it. But just know this. Often this is the underlying thinking in believing that by naming, that this naming by Adam was ordained by Yahweh. It was not. The word of Yahweh Elohim is what granted Ha-Adam the authority over the animals. Anyways, not the act of naming. Nothing in the text implies that Yahweh allowed or condoned man to define woman, even by a name. All right, so let's dig into this naming thing. Genesis 2:23, and Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called Isha because she was taken out of Ish." Isha is the female gender distinction. Ish is the male gender distinction. Note this, neither Isha or Ish is a name. They're just common nouns indicating gender. And interestingly enough, in Hebrew, Isha is not even etymologically connected with the word Ish. They're not from the same root. Isha is Aleph Sheen He, and Ish is Aleph Yud Sheen. Not from the same root at all. Okay, not from the same root word means that Isha does not mean maness, Adamah, Adam et, Mrs. Adam. It's showing that her identity does not revolve around her male counterpart. Here, Adam is not naming his wife. He's simply repeating what the narrator has already called her in the verse before. Now later, in Genesis 3:12, when he gets in trouble for eating of the forbidden fruit, he calls her the woman, definitely showing that it's not being used as a name. Now let's look back at the verse before this. And the Zelah, which Yahweh Elohim had taken from man, made he an Isha and brought her unto the man. Same word, Isha. Just like earlier when Yahweh Elohim had caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam and he built the woman, none of this was Adam's doing. He's just repeating what has already been decided. Let's see here what there is to learn about Hebrew naming patterns from Scripture. Okay, mothers typically named the children. Even in a patriarchal society where women were often viewed as possessions, the mothers typically gave the names to the children. Here's a few examples from Genesis. Hava named Cain and Seth. Lot's daughters named their sons. Rachel and Leah named all of Jacob's sons. Tamar named the twins. All right, let's look at some examples where this theory breaks down, this whole naming designates authority. Hagar, a woman and a slave, gives a name to the Almighty in Genesis 16. In Genesis 26, Isaac names wells at the very moment that he's relinquishing control over those wells. Now, it doesn't sound like much that authority is a part of those two witnesses, examples. All right, what is naming really about then if it's not about authority? Naming is an act that illustrates discernment. It's not a determiner of a person's or an item's essence, but it results from events that have occurred, that which has been discerned about the person. And Scripture often tells us the meaning of a name when the name is given. It's like the Scripture is explaining why this name happened at this moment. And then the context also gives us clues about the reason for the name. We see that often, especially when Rachel and Leah were naming the children. Oh, now my husband will love me, and then the name matches that, or different pieces of the story fit in with the names. Here's some examples just to show what I'm talking about the context fits the name. In Genesis 25, Jacob grabs his brother's heel, and he's named Usurper. Adam and Sarah laughed, and the baby Isaac is named Laughter. Sometimes people were renamed to change their identity, but I don't see this as the pattern of what's happening with Adam and his wife. Abram and Sarai, Yahweh changed their names. Here, the two chapters earlier than this, Yahweh tells us that Abraham believed Elohim and it was counted to him as righteousness. All right, Hebrews 11:11 tells us that Sarah conceived by faith past her time. This is Yahweh exercising discernment and giving them new names based on the faith in their hearts and wanting them to be recognized by that faith. He's not changing who they are. He's seen what's happened and is now changing their names. Mishael, Azariah, and Hananiah from Daniel 1 is another example of somebody trying to change their name to change their identity. But how well did it work with Nebuchadnezzar trying to change their names? Okay, sure, we remember their names best in English as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And part of that's probably from gospel music. But in any case, the events in Daniel 3 show us that this name-changing business did nothing to change their essence. These dudes were who they were. It was a failed attempt. Okay, you remember from part two, the Zakar and Nekevah that we went through? That's the male and the female, the words for male and female. Genesis 5:2 says, "Male and female created he them, and blessed them, and called their name Adam in the day when they were created." The word shamam, their name, is third person plural possessive. It's very clear, and he's talking about Ha-Adam being the essence of male and female together. In the day that they were created, they had already been given a name by their creator, because in the day that they were created, they were one, Echad. Okay, back to part one if you have any questions on that. All right, despite what we've been told, despite what we may have been thinking, the name Adam was not Yahweh's personal name for man, or the male creation, and Eve was not his personal name for the female creation. She is simply named Adam, the same name as her male counterpart. Now, later, Adam does give her a proper name of his own, presumably for reasons of his own. Genesis 3:20, "And Adam called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living." Now, a lot of people, you know, they know the difference between Eve and, now that they're in Hebrew roots, call her Chava. But same thing. The Hebrew word there is Chava, and it means life, living, or the first woman. It's the name of the first woman. It comes from the root word living or alive, Chai. Now, the theories that Adam was exercising authority over his wife by naming her, either by Yahweh's design using authority over her, or by Adam usurping that authority, they just don't play out in the text. An interesting question, however, is why does this man feel the need to name a woman who's already been given a name by Yahweh Elohim himself? Is a theory. Could it be that now that sin has entered the picture, they're no longer Echad? Maybe he doesn't want to share a name with her anymore? Sin has now caused a rupture in their relationship that only Yahweh can repair. Could it be that no longer Echad, Adam singles her out as her function of mother as opposed to wife? That flesh of my flesh, bone of my bones has been replaced by mother of all living? It's just a theory. We can't tell why from the text, but it is suspicious that Adam has given her name when she already had one. And I'll suggest this, that when we go through part four, there will be a lot more clues that might fill in some of this in our minds. You have heard it said, Adam named Eve, thereby illustrating that God had given him authority over her. But this is now debunked. You had heard it said, but may it be said no longer in the Messianic assembly. Plato, along with his teacher Socrates and his student Aristotle, helped to lay the foundation for Western philosophy and Western education models. His work, Timaeus, explains the origin of the universe according to Plato. Since human nature is twofold, the superior sex is that which hereafter should be designated man.
It's a mystery, and I don't like mysteries.
The Apocalypse of Moses. Okay, this quote is from the Pseudepigrapha. It's a Greek version of the Jewish text that's called The Life of Adam and Eve. Sometimes people have heard of that one more. Okay, so it dates from the first century AD. It recounts the lives of the first couple following their expulsion from the garden. According to this story, Adam and Eve were separated, and Adam stayed with the male animals while Eve stayed with the female animals. And here, Eve is telling the story of the fall to her children. And I cried out in that very hour, Adam, Adam, where art thou? Rise up, come to me, and I will show thee a great secret. But when your father came, I spake to him the words of transgression, which have brought us down from our great glory. For when he came, I opened my mouth, and the devil was speaking. And I began to exhort him and said, Come hither, my lord Adam, hearken to me, and eat of the fruit of the tree, which God told us not to eat of, it, and thou shalt be as God. Basically, it flat out lies about the Hebrew text. All right, this is a book, Genesis Rabbah is a book of the Babylonian Talmud. And the woman said to the serpent, Of the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat. Now, where was Adam during this conversation? Abba Halfong Bikoria said, He had engaged in his natural functions, intercourse, and then fallen asleep. Yeah, I kind of missed that in the text too. All right, let's re-examine another myth. You have heard it said, Eve brazenly engaged the serpent alone without Adam, and shame on her for it. Genesis 3:6. It seems straightforward enough, but let's break it down. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. Now that sounds like exactly what Paul talked about. The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. But we'll get to that a little bit more in part 4. All right, so breaking it down, let's look at this with her. All right, this is the Hebrew word imma. It means with, together with, beside, by, or accompanying. This word is used other places in the Tanakh. Genesis 30:16, Jacob lay with Leah. That sounds pretty with to me. Ruth 1:7, Ruth was with Naomi on the way back to Judah. 1 Samuel 1:24, Hannah took little Samuel with her to Shiloh. I mean, that's pretty with, right? I would also like to point out that the word im, meaning with, can be conjugated other ways. Imma is with her. Imanu means with us. If that sounds familiar, it's part of the name given in the prophecy in Isaiah 7:14, where the Alma is to bring forth a son, whose name means God with us. Now, if that with us doesn't really mean with us, then we may have bigger issues to concern ourselves with than marriage. Halot says, the Halot Hebrew lexicon says that this should be communal action or action in company. There's no question in any of the lexicons I checked that this is definitely meaning something was happening and they were together. Jacinius Hebrew grammar cites this phrase as an example of a preposition qualifying a noun apositionally and says that it is interpreted correctly only as her husband who was with her. There's no other way to translate it. Strong's numbers. The imma is also conjugated in such a way that it is third person feminine singular. It is referring directly to the woman. Now, people argue that this text really just means that Adam was with his wife in a theoretical sense based on their conjugal ties. But that doesn't really follow the flow of the text. 7 to 8 verses earlier than this, we just saw Adam rejoicing that this was finally bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. We walked through the covenant language of that in marriage part 1. And then the very next verse, Yahweh gives the instruction that man was to leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife. Okay, so why then, 7 verses down the road, can we be so quick to rationalize the explicit text that says he was right there? They're one flesh, but they're not together when something this big is going down? Right. See, we know that the Torah has no extra words. Every single word is there on purpose, for Yahweh's purposes to be exact. The thing is, this verse could have read just as well if it had only said, "And she gave also to her husband, and he did eat." The "with her" did not have to be there unless Yahweh decided it had to be there. Yahweh is drawing attention to the fact that Adam did nothing to prevent the deception that Eve fell into. Now, I promise we're going to dig into that one real deep in part 4. But this is where we have to look and use our critical thinking and come to the text fresh. There is nothing in the text to suggest that Adam said a word or that he interfered in any way with what was going down between his wife and the serpent. If he was supposed to be the spiritual leader, protecting his wife from the wiles of the enemy, he was falling down on the job. The text indicates that he stood idly by, listening without helping. Okay, now let's go on to some further evidence. All right, by the way, soon I'm going to show you how we know for sure that Adam wasn't out by himself watching the game, having a bud. I'm sorry, I just love that sound effect. Okay, Irenaeus was an early 2nd century bishop and father of the church. His writings were very formative in the development of Christian theology. His quote is, "But the woman, having heard of the command from Adam, treated it with contempt, either because she deemed it unworthy of God to speak by means of it, or because she had her doubts. Perhaps even held the opinion that the command was given to her by Adam of his own accord. The serpent found her working alone, so that he was enabled to confer with her apart." I know they didn't have a lot of copies of the scriptures back then, but it seems to me that a bishop of the church would have had access to one. I don't know, maybe he was just too busy creating doctrines to go check it. I don't know, he's busy. St. Jerome. All right, listen. This is a quote from the same St. Jerome who translated the Bible into Latin. Now, that might not sound like that big of a deal to us, but listen, for over 1,000 years, from 400 to 1530 AD, the Vulgate was the definitive edition of the most influential text in Western society. What this means is that for most Western Christians, well, you know, except for the bishops and stuff, it was the only version of the Bible ever encountered. The Vulgate's influence throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, even into the early modern period, is even greater than the King James versions in English. It was much more influential to them than KJV has been on Western society. For Christians during those times, the phraseology and the wording of the Vulgate permeated all areas of the culture. Just like how I always quote from KJV, I don't find it superior in any way. It's just that I cut my teeth as a believer on KJV. So now, even though I always go to Hebrew or Greek, when I'm flipping through my mental Rolodex of scriptures, they still pop up in King James English, right? I have the benefit of being able to check the Hebrew or the Greek. Praise Yah. But for the 1,000 years where the Vulgate was the predominant translation, those folks didn't have that benefit. For all they knew, Jerome's version was the very word of Yahweh. All right, a little quick side note. If anybody's familiar with Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, especially the prologue to The Wife of Bath's Tale, Canterbury Tales is a well-known, highly misogynist writing. Chaucer quotes from St. Jerome's work against Jovinian that I'm about to quote extensively. Now, before the quote, one last thing. Jerome, in his work as a translator, was influenced by his prejudices, and I submit that he allowed them to interfere with an accurate translation of the text. And the results were tragic. I'll show you one now, but in part 4 we'll look at more of the most insidious and I believe the most grievous to Abba's heart, fraudulent translations that Jerome made that have helped cause pretty much a holocaust against women over the centuries. Here's Jerome. It is good not to touch a woman. It is bad to touch one, for there is no opposite to goodness but badness. See how a wife is classed with the greatest evils? But if you reply that it's an odious wife, I will give you the same answer as before. The mere possibility of such danger is in itself no light matter. For he who marries a wife is uncertain whether he is marrying an odious woman or one worthy of his love. If she be odious, she is intolerable. If worthy of love, her love is compared to the grave, to the parched earth, and to fire. And this is the guy we had translating the scriptures into Latin. Uh-oh. Here's Jerome's translation of Genesis 3:6. Instead of saying she gave to her husband who was with her, it says she gave to her husband who ate. And Jerome worked, he worked from the Hebrew and the Greek Old Testaments. He had copies of both, and they both include with her. So his decision to leave it out of the Latin translation appears deliberate. Now let's look at some other people, even in modern days, who still propagate Jerome's errors with the text. Now one does have to wonder, with all the manuscripts available to modern translators, why this would still be happening. It appears that their glasses are Jerome-colored, or Greek pagan-colored. I'd be willing to bet they have Kool-Aid mustaches, too. All right, these are the English translations with which edit the Hebrew text and leave out Imma with her. I'm not condoning any of these Bible versions. I'm including this to show that there is clear bias in translation. Can we think of any other reason why these Bibles would leave out an entire Hebrew word when they have access to multiple reliable manuscripts that include it? When they have years of studying the nuances of Hebrew grammar under their belts? When they have teams of translators working together so that there's accountability and so that they can catch each other's errors? Revised Standard Version, Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition, Amplified Bible, Dewey Reams, 1899 American Edition, the Good News Translation, the Living Bible, the Message, okay, no surprise there, New Jerusalem Publishing Society, New Life Version, and the Wycliffe Bible. Why would they do this? All right, do we understand the importance of this? The question is, why is it not okay for translators to take away or add to the Hebrew text when we're dealing with the keeping the Torah verses, but it's okay to do it on verses that directly affect the life and the well-being of half the kingdom? Bibles that take away from the Hebrew text, leaving words untranslated, they encourage doctrines and practices that excuse the man and condemn the woman. Just because that's not what you heard in your church doesn't change the historical and the current reality of what's happened. This is so much more than, can Susie Q be a deacon? This is an example of the kind of thinking that's caused thousands of years of abuses against the daughters of Yah. Okay, let's pretend that it's not enough to make a case with an example of translation, here comes the F word, fraud, alone. Okay, let's just go back to the text and see if there's any more evidence to show that Adam was right there with his wife when she engaged the serpent and ate the fruit. Further evidence, Genesis 3, 1 through 3. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which Yahweh Elohim had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath Elohim said, Ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, Elohim hath said, Ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. All right, so we've seen that the text clearly shows that Adam was with her when it all went down. Let's look at the text to see if it gives us any more clues. Okay. And the serpent said unto the woman, Ye shall not surely die. For Elohim doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. Now, we're going to play detective. The red letters show us the players in this conversation. We got the serpent, and we've got the woman. And then we see the trail of dialogue starting in the yellow. And he said unto the woman, Why then, if these are the only two standing there, does the text say, And the woman said unto the serpent? And here it is again, in the next sentence, And the serpent said to the woman. Remember, we already know that there's no redundancy in the text, right? Every word is there to serve Yahweh's purpose. Matthew 5:18 shows us that Yeshua believed every stroke of the Hebrew text was significant, and we need to follow his example. All right, how about this? Genesis 3, 1 through 5. Ye shall not surely die. In the day ye eat thereof, your eyes shall be opened. Ye shall be as gods. All third person plural. In the South, we would say, Y'all shall not surely die. In the day y'all eat thereof, okay, this is third person plural. The serpent is speaking to more than one person here. And the woman answers with, We. Now, look, we're going to peek at behind the veil a little bit at the Hebrew for some clues, but don't be intimidated by the Hebrew. We don't need to be Hebrew scholars, okay? This is stuff we can find with a couple of free online tools. This is simple stuff. There is harder stuff to dig through in the Hebrew text, but this right here is simple. You can go online and get the free program eSword, download that, learn how to use it. There's blueletterbible.org, and there's scholarsgateway.com. Those are tools you can use. You don't have to be, just don't get scared. If we're going to go by what the text says, the weight of evidence points to the serpent speaking to the woman who was standing there with her husband, whom we have already seen based strictly on the text, is right there with her. The serpent is speaking to the woman, but Adam is also right there. We took care of this one. You had heard it said that Eve brazenly engaged the serpent alone without Adam, but may it be said no longer in the Messianic assembly. Moving right along. Aristotle. The male, unless constituted in some respect contrary to nature, is by nature more expert at leading than the female, and the elder and complete than the younger and incomplete. The relation of male to female is by nature a relation of superior to inferior and ruler to ruled. By nature? Really? Okay, we know that nature proves no such thing. And see, this is why they need Science Channel in classical Greece. All right, from their own mouths, here it comes. St. John Chrysostom, Archbishop of Constantinople, father of the church, he began his education under a pagan teacher. As we read this, try to remember that his name, Chrysostom, means golden-mouthed in Greek, and it was given to him on account of his legendary eloquence. His quote, "And what may be the cause of his setting them, women, under so great subjection? Because the woman is in some sort a weaker being and easily carried away and light-minded." Eloquent indeed.
But it's a mystery, and I don't like mysteries.
Philo. All right, Philo of Alexandria was a Hellenistic Jewish philosopher who lived in Egypt. Philo used philosophical allegory in his attempt to syncretize Greek philosophy and the teachings of the Tanakh. In Messianic circles, we're mostly used to consulting his writings as a historian because he was a contemporary of Yeshua in first century. Here's his quote. "But its juggleries and deceits, pleasure does not venture to bring directly to the man, but offers them to the woman, and by her means to the man, acting in a very natural and sagacious manner. For in human beings, the mind occupies the rank of man, and the sensations that of the woman." Do we understand how big a deal this is? I mean, we might kind of write this off and laugh, and that guy was an ancient, you know, who cares what he thought? But if you've gone through part one in particular, you know what a big deal, what a big influence these Greeks had on our teaching and the marriage teachings that we have to this very day. If we have ever thought to ourselves or said, or worse, that women are airheads or that women aren't as intellectually capable as men or women aren't rational the way that men are, or worse, if you're a woman and you've said, "I'm not like other women," then honestly, we've been drinking the Greeks' pagan Kool-Aid. In the Messianic community, we can get so paganoid about wreaths in our windows or the Star of David or whatever, but may I submit that the ramifications of having our worldviews regarding women and marriage spoon-fed to us by the Greeks is far more damaging to the kingdom than any of those smaller issues? Remember that the serpent was the most cunning animal in the garden. Okay, let's re-examine what we've been taught, another myth. You have heard it said, God questioned Adam about their sin because Adam was the authoritative representative and, quote, spiritual leader for the first family. Remember back in part one where I talked about the four pillars of patriarchy? Well, this is another one. Okay, here is a very simple explanation for why God asked Adam first. It's simply a matter of Hebrew structuring the word order to emphasize certain points. All right, this is about chiastic structure. A chiasm is a repetition of similar ideas in a reverse sequence. It's a thematic way of organizing narratives where the themes of the first half of the story are repeated in the second half. It's a matter of A matches up with A prime, B matches up with B prime, such as in this example from Joshua 1:5. I will be with you, I will never leave you is A. It matches up with A prime, I will be with you wherever you go. Be strong and courageous, B. B prime, be strong and courageous. It's just a way of ordering the text. All right, if you want to know some more about this, Tony Robinson from Restoration of Torah Ministries has some teaching on YouTube about chiastic structure. If you want to get into a basic teaching on it and not, like, you know, read books and books and books on it, that's a good place to start. Sometimes chiastic structure is an exact mirror image, and sometimes it has an unparalleled point right in the center that's usually the central message of the chiasm. Here's an example from Genesis 3. The serpent deceived the woman, matches up with Yahweh judges the deception and the reason for the serpent's punishment. B, the woman ate, matches up with B prime. Her answer, the serpent deceived me, I ate. See how it goes there? F in the middle is where Yahweh called to Adam. And based on the structure here, it looks like that may be the central theme of this chiasm. But in any case, this is a poetic structure. This could be the only reason that Yahweh asked in the order that he did. All right. Some people go back to the chronology and say that they asked Adam first because he was the leader. But it really could be just this simple. All right, but let's look at the actual questions and the answers to find out to whom, what was said to whom, because this can be considered a side issue, but the dialogue can't. Genesis 3, 9 through 12. And Yahweh Elohim called unto Adam and said unto him, Where art thou? And he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked, and I hid myself. And he said, Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree, whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldst not eat? And the man said, The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat. Significant to note is that Where art thou is second person masculine singular. It's very clear Yahweh is addressing just him. He didn't say, Where art y'all? Okay? All right. Question. If Yahweh set up a hierarchical system in which Adam was the leader and therefore responsible for both himself and his wife, why doesn't Yahweh ask Adam about her? All right, let's break down Adam's answers. And he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked, and I hid myself. I heard, first person, common, singular. You guys familiar with common? I had to learn this from somebody in the congregation. Common means that depending on the text, depending on the context, it could refer to either male or female. I heard, first person, common, singular. I was afraid. First person, common, singular. I was naked, masculine, singular. Back then, it couldn't go both ways. That one had to be masculine. I hid myself. First person, common, singular. For whom is Adam answering? Based on his answers, based on what the text shows us, who is he answering for? Himself or himself and his wife? All right, what happened next? Yahweh questions Adam further. Adam blames Yahweh and the woman. Okay, far from acting as a spokesman for the woman, Adam is her accuser as he tries to absolve himself by incriminating her. It's not who I would choose for my spokesman. All right, verse 13, Yahweh questions the woman directly. Ah, okay. So now Yahweh is questioning the woman directly. Let's look at that conversation. But wait. Where's the part where Yahweh questions Adam about the woman? Did we miss it in the text? Genesis 3:13. And Yahweh Elohim said unto the woman, What is this that thou hast done? And the woman said, The serpent beguiled me, and I did eat. What have you done? Feminine singular. Her answer, beguiled me. First person common singular. I did eat. First person common singular. Yahweh is asking her directly, and she is answering for herself. So here's the thing. If Yahweh had set up an authority structure between Adam and the woman, he has now completely ignored his own structure in asking the woman directly about her sin. Earlier, the serpent addressed his questions directly to the woman, and folks say that she usurped Adam's authority in answering them. So, now Yahweh has asked a question directly of her. Is she usurping Adam's authority again? Or is Yahweh showing us that she is directly accountable to him without an intermediary? What does the text say? You had heard it said, Yahweh questioned Adam about their sin because Adam was the authoritative representative and spiritual leader for the first family. But may it be said no longer in the Messianic assembly. Tertullian, in his famous work on the apparel of women, he had a lot of opinions about how women should be dressed. And do you not know that you are each an Eve? The sentence of God on this sex of yours lives in this age. The guilt must of necessity live too. You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that forbidden tree. You are the first deserter of the divine law. You are she who persuaded him whom the devil was not valiant enough to attack. You destroyed so easily God's image, man. On account of your desert, that is death, even the Son of God had to die. Poor Tertullian in the South, we would say, bless his heart, he is going to roll over in his grave when we get to the myths about Paul's view of women. All right, let's check in with Brother Judah. Babylonian Talmud, Genesis Rabbah again. And the man called his wife's name Eve, Hawa, i.e. life. She was given to him for an advisor, but she played the eavesdropper like the serpent. Another interpretation, he showed her how many generations she had destroyed. Rabbi Aha interpreted it, the serpent was thy Eve's serpent, i.e. seducer, and thou art Adam's serpent. So we have here one rabbi saying that Adam named the woman Hava, life, because he was showing her how many generations of life she had to destroy by her sin. Okay, and incidentally, let's not pass over the idea that the Talmud says Hava was an eavesdropper and Adam's seducer. Somehow it was decided that these ideas should be preserved for the ages in the Talmud so we could all benefit. It appears that Brother Judah was not immune to the influence of Hellenism's misogyny after all. Let's look at another myth. You have heard it said, Adam sinned by listening to the nagging and cajoling voice of his wife Eve, who usurped Adam's authority by eating the fruit and giving some to him. All right, we're going to deal with the first part of this myth, the nagging and cajoling part, real quick. Genesis 3:6. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. We got took, ate, gave. No dialogue recorded. We know that the woman said something to Adam because Yahweh in another place said that Adam had hearkened unto her voice. And the teaching for millennia has been that she wore him down and pestered the life out of him until he finally gave in. In truth, there is no evidence in the scriptures to support this concept. There's not a single verse in any manuscript in any language that records any dialogue. Now, this is one of those places I can hear Proverbs 30, verse 6 running through my head. Add thou not unto his words, lest he reprove thee, and thou be found a liar. This is an understanding that cannot be extracted from the text unless it's first smuggled into the text. Now let's go on to the rest of this myth. Genesis 3:11. And he said, "Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldst not eat?" What's Yahweh making reference to here? He is asking Adam about what he's done, specifically referencing his earlier command not to eat of that tree. Right? Genesis 3:17. And unto Adam he said, "Because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, Thou shalt not eat of it." The hearkened unto is the word shema. Because you shema'd the voice of your wife. Again, Yahweh is mentioning his command about not eating from that tree. We also have Yahweh mentioning that Adam shema'd the voice of his wife, with no mention of any command to not shema his wife. So when we read this in context, there's actually no evidence in the text that it was a bad thing to listen to his wife per se. Kind of like, it would be like our kids getting in trouble for doing something that we never told them not to do. If we look at the context, this is about Adam shemaing the voice of his wife instead of heeding Yahweh's command. No reference to disobeying any command about not shemaing his wife, and twice he references his command about not eating of that tree. What is the sin here? All right, conspicuously absent in this text, any reference to Yahweh calling out Adam for not leading his wife? Any reference to Yahweh calling out the woman for stepping out from under her covering, under her husband's covering? No objection is raised to the woman, either as a woman or as a wife, by Yahweh or Adam for her assuming leadership. Adam's already blamed her for giving him the fruit. He obviously has no qualms about pointing the finger at her. So why doesn't he mention anything about her usurping his authority? Which is kind of foolish anyways, because since when is answering a question that was addressed to you, like when the serpent spoke to her, considered assuming leadership? But nowhere in the text does it indicate that the woman was taken to task because she failed to, quote, stay in her place. Furthermore, where are the instances in Scripture in which a woman acts independently of her husband and is called down for it? In fact, there are none. And in fact, there are a number of examples in Scripture where quite the opposite happens. Women act independently of their husbands and are blessed for such behavior. Woman as a free agent. Let's look at example number one, Yael. This chick was bad to the bone. You guys know the story. I'm going to assume everybody knows the story in Judges 4 and 5. In the story, a couple things we're going to pick out from the text. There's no mention of her husband's whereabouts. No permission asked for. No, honey, do you think it would be a good idea if I go and slay, you know, the general of the opposing army? Nothing. In fact, Judges 5:24 in the Song of Deborah and Barak, it specifically mentions that she is most blessed of women. This is a fierce woman. She hammered a tent peg into Sisera's head until it was fastened to the ground. Can you even imagine doing such a thing? Example number two, woman as a free agent, Deborah, also Judges 4 and 5. I'm going to also assume that we know this story, but we're going to pick some things out. Her husband is barely mentioned. She is a prophetess of the Most High. I hope we don't look over that lightly. A judge of Israel. It's the same Hebrew word that they use about Moses and the other judges mentioned in the whole book of Judges. She's a judge, just like every other man that was a judge. In Septuagint, it says that the mighty men in Israel failed until Deborah arose. And then she commands Barak and more. As a prophet, she had spiritual leadership. As a judge, she exercised judicial and political power. And she directed battlefield strategy, leading to a massive military victory. All right. Critical thinking. Take off the glasses. Common teaching in Christianity is that the reason God chose Deborah and he used Yael is because there were no men standing up and being men at this time in Israel. So a woman had to step in, you see. That Yahweh was forced to use a woman only because there was no one else, and that this was actually a shameful thing for Israel to have to endure. I have heard that teaching ad nauseum in the church. So I could maybe understand that thinking pattern if this was a situation where Yahweh was punishing Israel, but it's not. He gives them victory in war here, not punishment. Okay, so I am all about doing due diligence to understand the other side of an argument. So let's look now at the scriptures used to support the idea that Yael and Deborah were only used by Yahweh in order to shame Israel by being led and delivered by a woman. That was all of them, right there. In truth, okay, if we're going to be honest with ourselves and look at the text critically, there is no evidence in the scriptures to support that concept. And I would submit that there is much to put that idea to death once and for all. Really. I mean, just think about this. If Abba wanted to get our attention and teach us a lesson and about the shame Israel experienced because of being led and delivered by women, where is it in the text? Why isn't it included somewhere? If Leviticus 5 teaches us that we're only accountable for what we know, and it does, then why would Adam be in trouble for something that Yahweh never told him about? It would be a setup. But we know that that can't be the case because we know that Yahweh Elohim's throne is established on righteousness and justice. And that would not be just. So, no evidence in the text of shame because Yael was a woman. No evidence in the text of shame because Deborah was a woman. None. Okay, I'm back on track. We were discussing how nowhere does the text indicate that the woman was taken to task because she failed to stay in her place. But there are a number of examples in Scripture where the opposite happens. Women act independently of their husbands and are blessed for such behavior. Let's look at two quick more examples. Abigail. I'm not going to act like we don't all know the story of Abigail and Nabal. 1 Samuel 25, in case you don't, go look it up. But I'm operating under the assumption that we've passed over a lot of details in the story. Okay. Background information is that we know that her husband is an evil, obstinate fool that no one can appeal to or warn. If you think I'm adding something there, go back and read the text. Understand what the name Nabal means. And this is a woman who has decided and acted independently of her husband. Here's some thoughts about King David's beliefs in this story. In the text, it tells us that he believed that her counsel to him was Yahweh's will. We're talking about a woman who gave the anointed king unsolicited counsel, and he believed God told her to do it. He believed Yahweh used her counsel to save him. And the text clearly says that he shamad Abigail's counsel. When Yahweh did intervene in this situation, he did not punish her for disobeying her husband, but he gave her a permanent release from that evil and obstinate fool that she was married to. This was a woman who was an Azer Kenegdo. Go back to Marriage Part 2 for a thorough understanding of Azer Kenegdo. She was an Azer Kenegdo who aided her husband by going against his wishes. Next example, Hannah. This is the story in 1 Samuel chapters 1 and 2. This is a woman who made a Nazarite vow to Yahweh Zevaot for the son that she was asking him for. She decided and acted independently of her husband. She did not ask permission. She simply told him her plans. Her husband acknowledged her right to determine her plans and the plans of their son. Hannah and her husband were both blessed with many more children because of Hannah's actions. The text clearly says that it was because of what Hannah did. 1 Samuel 3:19 and 20 shows us that all of Israel was blessed by her actions because her son turned out to be a prophet. Okay. If in Malachi 3:6 Yahweh tells us that he doesn't change, what are we to make of these examples? Are these examples of times where Yahweh ignored his own structure and plan, showing us that he is schizophrenic? Or are these examples to show us that maybe we didn't have his plan figured out correctly? All right, I'm just going to throw in a random slide just as a reminder, a mini biblical exegesis lesson. Okay. Step one, remove the colored glasses, come to the text without firmly entrenched ideas about what it will contain. I will say this, that is not possible in the flesh. That is a move of the Holy Spirit, and you need to pray for this to happen because it takes a lot to fight our flesh when we're looking at the text. Number two, read what the text says in the original language. Go back to that analogy, don't try to kiss the bride through the veil. Number three, don't read into the text what's not there. It sounds simple, but it's harder than it sounds. For example, in the story about Deborah, you can't get from the text that it was shameful unless you automatically read led by a woman with that tone in your voice. I mean, if you already have that, it's hard to come to the text unaffected. Number four, ask yourself, what does the text say? All right, so obviously there's more to it than that, but those are the minimum requirements of the process. All right, back to our trail of evidence again. Was it sin for Adam to listen to the voice of his wife? All right, let's look at some evidence from another couple in Scripture. Genesis 16:2, and Sarai said unto Abram, behold now, Yahweh hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. He shema'd his wife. Are we recognizing that word? Shin, mem, ayin. The same word used in Deuteronomy 6. Shema Israel, Yahweh Elohenu, Yahweh Echad. Abram submitted to Sarai's wishes, and he acknowledged her authority over her maid. He shema'd the voice of his wife. The same word that people used to say that Adam's sin, or at least part of his sin, was listening to his wife. So we should see next where Yahweh takes Abram to task about shema'ing the voice of his wife, right? The scriptures are all about repeating patterns. Adam shema'd his wife and got in trouble, and now Abram is shema'ing his wife and he'll get in trouble. But what really happened? Genesis 21:10 through 12. Wherefore she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son. And Elohim said unto Abraham, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad, and because of thy bondwoman. And all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Yahweh just told him to shema his wife. It's the same word. This is an important enough text that Paul in Galatians 4:30 quoted Sarah's instruction to Abraham, the one that Yahweh just told him to shema. Paul wasn't afraid of this text, neither should we be. So So what are we to take from this? Is Yahweh going against his established order and telling Abraham to disregard his previously clearly understood hierarchy? That's what we've been taught, but is it true? All right, let's mentally go back to the creation account for a minute. Again, conspicuously absent is any divine prescription for a man-woman authority structure. There were other authority structures. They were clearly put into place there. Yahweh gave us commands. He gave us commands to show us that he was in hierarchy over us. He is our authority. And we saw in Marriage Part 1 how Elohim gave the blessings and the commands to be fruitful, to multiply, to replenish, to subdue the earth, and to take dominion. Equally, he gave those commands equally to all that was Ha'adam, meaning man and woman. God over humans, humans over animals. But where, oh where, is the instruction about hierarchy between man and woman? For all that such a hierarchy would affect, as important as it would be to humanity, why would Yahweh leave that out? Did he leave it out? Or have we just been guilty of eisegesis because of our colored glasses, reading into the text what is not there again? You had heard it said, Adam sinned by listening to the nagging and cajoling voice of his wife Eve, who usurped Adam's authority by eating the fruit and giving some to him. But may it be said no longer in the Messianic assembly. A marriage part 4 will cover much more in Genesis 3 regarding the marriage relationship. We have barely scratched the surface. Now, Yah willing and the creeks don't rise. Part 4 will cover myths like these. Adam was held responsible for Eve's bringing sin into the world because he was the one in charge. Yahweh cursed Eve with having Adam rule over her. That woman's submission was ordained by Yahweh as a punishment for sin. And that women are morally inferior and more easily deceived than men. Soren Kierkegaard, the 19th century Danish philosopher, I quoted this in Marriage Part 1, but I thought it was important enough to say again. He said, "Indeed, one can be deceived in many ways. One can be deceived in believing what is untrue, but on the other hand, one is also deceived in not believing what is true." 2 Timothy 2:15 tells us that we need to study to show ourselves approved unto Elohim, workmen that needeth not be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. We need to divide the word itself from the traditions handed down to us from our fathers. James 1:5 tells us that if any of us lacks wisdom, that we should ask our Abba, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to us. Torah being abolished was not the only lie handed down to us. Now let's be brave and put everything on the table and allow Abba to help us sort it out. As Lee Miller says, "I don't care what the truth is. I just want to find it so I can walk in it." I beg you, whatever you do, don't walk away from this teaching and think you have heard it all. I want you to walk away from this teaching and do your homework. Check what I've said. Look in the Hebrew text. Use some of those resources I mentioned and check it out and see if it's true. Acts 17:11 says, "Now these Jews were more noble than those in Thessalonica. They received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if those things were true. Do not take my word for it. Do your homework." Thank you.
Amen.
Frozen. Yeah, I'll take questions now. If anyone has questions directly on this presentation, if your question is not on this presentation, my likely answer will be that's part one or that's part two.